Hello, this is your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer reader, Joanne Lowney, with the Christian Science Monitor for Tuesday, July 21st, 2026. And here are today's news briefs. Zelensky fires Ukraine's military chief following protests. Ukraine's President Vladimir Zelensky has capitulated to popular protests and dismissed Commander-in-Chief Oleksandr Syrsky. Major General Mykhailo Drapetai steps into the role. He's credited with leading critical defense and offensive operations and spearheading reforms to modernize training, digitalize command, and streamline recruitment and logistics. The change of command follows 6 days of protests over the removal of Mykhailo Fedorov, a young defense minister who clashed with Syrsky. 5:03 p.m. ET staff. The Trump administration opened a new investigation into Harvard. The Justice Department announced it was probing whether the university was using Chinese funds to create scholarships that exclude American students in violation of civil rights laws. Harvard has accepted at least $630 million in funding from Chinese sources, the agency said. The department said it had not reached any conclusions. The investigation marks a new salvo in the Trump administration's campaign against Harvard, which it has targeted with federal funding cuts and allegations of anti-Semitism. 4:14 p.m. ET staff. There will be no more elections in Nicaragua, says President Daniel Ortega. In office since 2007, Mr. Ortega has increasingly cracked down on public protests and any hint of opposition, including shuttering more than 5,000 civil society organizations since 2018. In his July 19th speech marking the anniversary of 1979 Sandinista Revolution, when Mr. Ortega helped overthrow a brutal U.S.-backed dictator, he said never, never, never would Nicaragua hold elections where U.S.-backed parties could participate. On July 21st, Secretary of State Marco Rubio called on the international community to join forces against these anti-democratic moves. 2:40 p.m. ET, staff. Scottish runner Josh Kerr shatters men's mile world record. Mr. Kerr ran a 3-minute 42-second .66 race in London on Saturday, beating the long-standing record by .47 seconds. Morocco's Hicham El Garouji held a top spot for 27 years after his own historic race in Rome. There was a lot of negotiation with my own body and my mind, Mr. Kerr told The Athletic. He was cheered on by 60,000 onlookers at London Stadium. When the pressure is on, I show up, he said. 1:50 p.m. ET staff. ICE expands arrests, new data show. Monday's update revealed record arrests under the Trump administration so far, as pushback against immigration and customs enforcement tactics grows. ICE reported a high of more than 1,300 daily bookends on average in June, and even higher in the first couple of weeks of July. Though not at an all-time high, ICE detention also grew to 65,765 people as of July 11th. Less than a third of those detained are convicted criminals, according to agency data. The government can deport people without criminal convictions if they violate immigration law. 11:40 a.m. ET staff. Officials sought phone records of New York Times journalists and their relatives. A court document says President Donald Trump's administration sought New York Times journalists' phone records and even those of some of their relatives in an attempt to unmask the confidential sources of reporters who wrote about Trump's Qatari-gifted Air Force One jet. The motion unsealed Monday reveals more expensive attempts by Trump's Republican administration than previously known to compel the identity of sources. The Justice Department has justified the original subpoenas by saying, "Reporters are not the targets. Those leaking classified information are." Additional subpoenas included a request for phone records of one reporter's mother and two of the journalist's spouses. 10:52 a.m. ET, Associated Press. Israel is building miles-long earthen barrier inside Gaza, entrenching division. The Israeli military is rapidly constructing a large earthen barrier in the Gaza Strip, further entrenching the division of the tiny Palestinian enclave. Satellite images show that more than 14 miles have been built in recent months. Israel's military confirmed to the Associated Press that it is building a physical barrier. The berms roughly follow the so-called yellow line, a boundary set by the U.S.-backed ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas. Palestinians fear the line could become a permanent border. The military says it has developed a security zone along the barrier, equipped with intelligence assets. 8:18 a.m., ET, Associated Press. President Trump imposed 50% tariffs on range of Canadian products. The move Monday sharply escalates a trade dispute that has strained relations between the two longtime allies. The levies, which take effect August 19th, apply to goods ranging from hockey sticks to dairy products, and unlike previous rounds of tariffs, do not exempt many items traded under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement, USMCA. The White House said it invoked a Great Depression-era law against Canada, along with China, retaliated against Mr. Trump's earlier tariffs rather than negotiating a deal. The move further tests North American unity, despite the continent's deeply integrated economy. 7:21 a.m. ET, Staff. Our first article is on the Iran war. Under Iranian fire, Jordan faces a balancing act and messaging challenge. By Taylor Luck, Special Correspondent. Amman Jordan. As the United States and Iran escalate their conflict and the truce collapses, Iran is directing much of its fire not at Washington's wartime partner, Israel, but at one of its most reliable Arab partners, Jordan. Iranian forces struck U.S. military assets in Jordan on Tuesday for the fourth day in a row. Over the weekend, Iranian missiles killed two U.S. troops in a Jordanian Airbus and targeted the kingdom's lone port and an international airport in Aqaba. As U.S.-Iranian fighting reignites, American ally Jordan, which hosts U.S. forces, has increasingly come under Iranian fire. Dependent on U.S. aid, but eager to avoid angering Iran or creating domestic concerns, it is choosing its words carefully. The attacks have thrust the kingdom into an ever-difficult balancing act, observers say. Jordan depends on U.S. military and economic support and remains one of Washington's most reliable allies, while it downplays that coordination to offset public anger over U.S. Middle East policy in Israel's war in Gaza. At the same time, it stresses to Iran it's not party to the war. Since the ceasefire began to crumble, with the exchanges of fire over shipping through the Strait of Hormuz, Iran has spared Jordan's neighbor, Israel, which joined with the U.S. in launching the war against Tehran. Iran's missiles are disrupting Jordan's economy, but Jordan's leadership has shown no indication of lessening the country's military an economic reliance on the U.S. or retaliating against Iran. The U.S. partnership is a matter of Jordanian sovereignty, says Jawad Anani, a former Jordanian foreign minister. But we don't want Jordan to be an arena of conflict between Iran, Israel, or anyone else. And we have told the Iranians this 100 times. Yet in messaging to its citizens, the Jordanian government has said little about the Iran war, its security ties with the U.S., and the location and severity of Iranian strikes on Jordanian soil. Annual U.S. assistance to Jordan has increased from $450 million in 2003 to a record $2 billion in 2026. American military personnel and hardware are present on Jordanian military bases owned and operated by the Jordan Armed Forces. There are no American-run military bases in Jordan. Since the first round of U.S.-Iran fighting, additional U.S. military personnel shifted from Gulf Arab states to Jordan, the New York Times reported. We are not, at the onset, protecting Israel or attacking Iran, and it is not our interest to enter a war, says Jordanian political analyst Nabil Gishan. But at the same time, we cannot retaliate against Iran, and collectively the Gulf and Jordan cannot pressure the U.S. to enter negotiations. We're stuck in the middle. In press statements, Jordanian officials say missiles in its airspace, Iranian or otherwise, are a violation of Jordanian sovereignty. Yet its careful messaging has left the Jordanian public largely unaware and unprepared should the war escalate. Since King Abdullah II ascended to the throne in 1999, Jordan has been a key facilitator for U.S. military operations across the region, codified in 2021, U.S.-Jordan Defense Cooperation Agreement. Jordan served as a critical logistics hub for the U.S. military invasion and occupation of neighboring Iraq from 2003 to 2010, and for anti-terror operations. From 2014 to 2020, Jordanian Airbuses served served as the headquarters and launching pad for the U.S.-led coalition against Islamic State forces in Iraq and Syria. Prior to the U.S.-Iran war, there were some 3,000 U.S. troops on Jordanian soil, according to the Biden administration. Left over from anti-ISIS operations, they were largely based at an airbase in eastern Jordan. While Jordan has over the years faced blowback for its ties to America with several Al-Qaeda and ISIS attacks, the Iran war is drawing Jordan into regional conflict more than ever before. Despite multiple requests, Jordanian officials refused to comment for this story, saying they're not accepting interviews and directing the monitor to official statements. Yet, the war has clearly impacted local thinking about the kingdom's position. For Arab states, there's no alternative to the U.S. as our main ally and security partner, says Mr. Gishan, the analyst. But America has left Jordan exposed. Arab states must reevaluate their allegiance and partnership with the U.S. Although Jordanians generally oppose Israel, Iran's arch foe, this does not necessarily translate into support for Iran. America started this war with Iran on behalf of Israel to support the Israeli project of expansion and occupation in the region, says Mohammed, an Amman shopkeeper who withheld his full name for fear of legal repercussions. Iran wants to control this region too. As Jordanians, what does this war have to do with us? It's not our war. Suspicions over Iran's intentions in Jordan and among Palestinians take on political, ethnic, and religious dimensions in Jordan, home to 95% Sunni Muslims. There is no sizable Shiite population which comprise the majority in Iran. We saw Iran slaughter Sunni Muslims in Syria and Iraq. We have seen them try to infiltrate the Gulf. And now they wish to bully Jordan, says Mohammed Abdulaftif, a Jordanian valley farmer who describes himself as an independent patriot. We can disagree about the government's foreign policy. We don't like American policy. We want an end to Israeli domination. But Iran is a direct threat to our safety and lives, he says. Those who have allied to the U.S. have seen progress, technology, and growth, says Oda, a coffee barista in Amman, who withheld his full name. What has the Iranian Axis ever offered? Militias, mafias, non-functioning states, and death. Complicating Jordan's response is that unlike Gulf states, the government has not clearly depicted Iranian attacks as a threat to the kingdom or prepared its population for war, Jordanian analysts say. Instead, the government has downplayed the war's impact, depicting daily life as normal and the stability of the kingdom as unaffected. On Sunday, minutes after the U.S. Embassy issued a warning to American citizens that Jordanian authorities had evacuated the Aqaba port and airport due to a credible threat, Jordan denied it. Less than an hour later, Iranian ballistic missiles were intercepted above the sites. It marks a stark contrast to Jordan's approach to the fight against ISIS a decade ago when it united the country against an extremist group. It held mass rallies against ISIS, participated in the U.S.-led coalition, and explained clearly to its citizens why hosting U.S. and European militaries was necessary. What are you going to do? Keep on denying? U.S. military cooperation and the Iranian threat, says Amir al-Sabela, a Jordanian analyst. You have to have Jordanians feel and understand the risk they're facing. Iran, for its purposes, is trying to fill that narrative void. Last Sunday, Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps thanked the people and military personnel of Jordan for fulfilling a religious duty, ostensibly for supplying information, enabling the lethal precision strikes on U.S. forces at Jordan's Azraq base. Multiple Gulf and Western security sources and Jordanian analysts discount the statement as propaganda, but it stirred controversy and suspicion on Jordanian social media. Without clearly communicating day by day, the government creates an internal vacuum. This allows Iran to mobilize Jordanians and talk directly to Jordanians, warns Mr. Sabela. This leaves Jordan caught between Iran and the U.S. Right now, Jordan is walking on a knife's edge in between two fires, says Mr. Grishin. And from the Education Department, our next article, in the AI age, internships have higher stakes. There are ways to maximize the experience. By Ira Porter, staff writer, Medara Udokong, staff writer. Lucy Rice works 20 hours a week at an unpaid internship, writing and editing stories for a weekly hyperlocal newspaper in New York City. She plans to finish graduate school and then look for work that would eventually allow her to produce longer explanatory journalism. A friend told her about Strauss News, where she's one of 10 interns. She took the position because she needed experience. So far, among other assignments, she has covered an election night watch party as a wave of New York candidates, backed by Mayor Zoran Mandani, won primaries, and has reported on a Spanish language group chat that Mr. Mamdani just started to engage community members. The first month and a half of summer, I wasn't doing anything journalism related. She says, I was working random jobs to save money so that I could afford to do this internship. Employers are contracting more interns even as concerns grow that artificial intelligence will eliminate many of the entry-level jobs new workers would typically get. Experts say an internship is a chance to show the soft skills that might not be apparent on a resume. I want to be a bit more intentional about the stories that I'm working on for the last month, Ms. Rice says. She knows she's not getting an offer when she's done. The Manhattan newsroom of Strauss News, where she works, only has one editor and one full-time reporter. According to the National Association of Colleges and Employers, more than 4 million U.S. college students complete internships during the school year or over the summer. NACE says that employers report wanting to hire 4% more interns in 2026, which follows a sharp decline the previous year. For students like Ms. Rice and recent graduates, internships offer experience, exposure, and networking opportunities, but the potential to convert them to full-time jobs varies widely by industry. Still, experts say there are some steps to get the most out of the experience. Michelle Moyer is the Director of Career Development and Community Engagement at Cedar Crest College, a small women's college in Allentown, Pennsylvania. She thinks there's a science to the timing of inquiring about full-time work while still interning, and a mindset that students or recent graduates must have when they go into the experience. Employers are getting workers, but they're also additioning employees, Ms. Moyer cautions students to remember. With the cost of recruiting, hiring, and onboarding an employee, it's a great way for them to learn a lot about a student before they have to take commitment. Ms. Moyer preaches professionalism, being a self-starter, and punctuality to her students. Showing hard skills is important, but soft skills are also important also, she says. We're trying to make sure that students really understand that and know that how to grow in these competencies is important, and to show employers that, hey, I'm really good as a team player, and here's how I can show you that. Rayan Islam is an international student from Bangladesh going into his senior year at Denison University, a small school near Columbus, Ohio. After being turned down for a research internship last summer, he applied again and was accepted. It came with $4,500 stipend and housing to work on a numerical linear algebra research project at Ohio State University. It was a relief to get the internship, Mr. Islam says. I knew that I'd have a job and that I could do some research this summer, so it wasn't going to be a waste of time. Five other potential employers rejected him before this internship came through. Some of the work he wanted to do, he couldn't because he's not a U.S. citizen. He isn't looking to be hired full-time because he has to finish school. After that, he wants to start graduate school and eventually get his Ph.D. It's harder these days to get any kind of job, and it's only going to get more difficult in 5 or 6 years. Probably when I graduate from grad school and I'm looking for jobs, says Mr. Islam, who says he wants to be a college professor one day. Andrea St. James, Executive Director for Career Education at Western New England University, says leveraging networks is smart. With AI threatening to eliminate some entry-level jobs that recent graduates would typically get, being proactive is akin to being entrepreneurial. I take the philosophy that with your career, you study a specific discipline. But in addition to that, you're an entrepreneur. You have to be an entrepreneur with your life, she says. That means looking at things from different angles and seeing where else your skill set works. If you're an accounting major and AI takes over some of those entry-level jobs, you know what? There are a lot of other companies that have a financial component to it, she says. Ms. St. James says that's a better way of being strategic, of considering what your skills bring to the table and how you can use them. It can be scary, it can be overwhelming, it can be frustrating, but how can we look at things in a different way so we can maintain that momentum. And now from Africa, we have surrounded by warring factions, Sudan's El Obeid must rely on local relief. By Mat Nashed, contributor, Cairo. Hamid dove on the ground after hearing a drone whiz by overhead. Seconds later, he felt the earth shake when a nearby fuel tanker exploded. Covered in dust, Hamid got up to check on his friends before running to the site of the blast, where he joined dozens of bystanders and volunteers to take survivors to the hospital. Many of the injured needed urgent surgery, or they would die, Hamid says, about the June 28th drone strike. The Christian Science Monitor agreed to identify him and other sources for this story with pseudonyms, because they fear retaliation by local military forces. Local humanitarian groups in El Obeid, a city near the front lines in Sudan's civil war, have set up emergency response rooms to provide critical assistance for the civilian population. Hamid is in his mid-30s, and he's one of several thousand local relief workers in the city of El Obeid, Sudan. It's now the front line of the country's civil war between the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, and the National Army, known as the Sudanese Armed Forces, or SAF. The city sits at a crossroads between SAF-controlled northern and eastern Sudan and RSF-held territory to the south and west, making it a strategically vital location. When Sudan's civil war erupted in April 2023, neighborhood groups known as emergency response rooms emerged across the country. They grew out of an old Sudanese tradition called nafir, which translates as call to mobilize or collective work. These ERRs rely on remittances, aid grants, and community donations to finance relief efforts. Both warring parties have targeted local activists with these groups for their perceived opposition to either side. Hamid, who works with the ERR in El Obeid, says volunteers are overwhelmed right now because clean water is hard to find, and medical facilities are struggling to keep up with demand. According to the UN, more than 15 million people have been displaced during Sudan's civil war, and nearly 20 million face acute levels of hunger. El Obeid alone hosts at least 100,000 displaced people, many of whom live in makeshift, open-air camps under the scorching sun. Some of the camps consist of hundreds of huts built mainly out of tree branches, straw, and pieces of fabric. "We're doing everything possible to help them," said Ahmed, another ERR volunteer. "However, there's a major fuel crisis and lack of transport. The situation is really hard." Both the RSF and SAF have diverted food assistance earmarked for civilians living outside their control, according to the UN. "Food is the most urgent issue right now in El Obeid," says Hamid. "We also fear there could be a drought in a city that already has limited resources." Volunteers often buy staples such as rice and lentils from local markets and prepare meals for the crowds that gather at communal kitchens. Activists also distribute food to displaced families, prioritizing families staying in abandoned buildings or crowded apartments. The camps are closely guarded by military authorities and receive some food assistance from global aid groups, says Musa, a local ERR member. Meanwhile, volunteers are organizing blood drives amid acute shortages at hospitals. The campaign is critical due to the rising casualties from RSF drone strikes. Musa explains by text message to the monitor that civilians rely on volunteer facilities because they can't trust the SAF to run them. The SAF-backed Ministry of Health's priority is to provide medical and life-saving supplies to SAF forces. For instance, civilians don't benefit from the ministry's blood bank at all, Musa said. The SAF did not respond to a query question from the monitor about the allegation. Over the last 16 months, the RSF has surrounded El Obeid from the west, north, and south. Some civilians have decided to flee the city, fearing that they could soon face atrocities like those carried out in El Fasher last year. The population that has stayed is forced to get by with less and less. The threat of drone strikes has dissuaded many traders and fuel tanker drivers from entering the city, though some still slip through at night on perilous journeys from the east. It's a huge risk for drivers because the RSF targets any trucks that it suspects are carrying support to SAF, says Montasser, a resident of El Obeid. Civilians are worried that the RSF could soon cut off access to the city from the east. That prospect terrifies Hamid, the relief worker who survived the drone strike. He says basic food stocks would quickly disappear. Civilians would also struggle to get out of the city, he adds in a text message. Whatever happens, Hamid insists that he and his ERR volunteers won't abandon their communities. The people of El Obeid have faith in us, he says. They know that we have to rely on each other. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Joanne Lowney. If you miss any part of this program, you can get it on demand on our website, sunsounds.org. Then click on our broadcast info and audio. You can take Sun Sounds with you. Get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. And you can hear Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or smart home device. Now back to the next article. Our next article is from the magazine, 15 Years On, Joplin's Civic Updraft, by Stephanie Haynes, staff writer. Much of the country met Joplin, Missouri on the city's worst day, May 22, 2011. That's when an EF5 tornado tore through the metropolis of some 50,000 people, shredding a path several miles long and three-quarters of a mile wide. More than 150 people died. It was one of the deadliest tornadoes in U.S. history. In this week's magazine, you'll meet Joplin again, but through a very different lens. 15 years have passed since that disaster, and writer Henry Bruinis, as part of his summer-long project traveling Route 66, spent time in this Midwest community to explore what it means to rebuild. This can lead to profound questions. How does a place come back, and how do people come back to a place? What is shelter, and how does a community change, evolve, and embrace the new when the old landmarks of life are literally or metaphorically blown away? 15 years after one of the country's deadliest tornadoes, writer Harry Bruinis goes to Joplin, Missouri, and to explore what it means for a community to rebuild. Other stories in our magazine this week explore similar themes. Some answers run through this issue in Harry's story and in others. Taylor Luck writes of a new sense of resilience and community pride forming within the United Arab Emirates in the face of attacks from Iran. Contributor Nor Alden Jadot writes from Sudan about how a war-torn society reconstructs its artistic heritage after and despite conflict. For Harry and his editor, Scott Blanchard, Joplin has a special resonance. Scott was there before, back in 2011. About 2 months after the tornado, he volunteered to help the local newspaper, the Joplin Globe, as it covered the disaster. Scott recalls driving towards the city, wondering when he would see the damage. It was fine for several blocks, and then it's right in front of you, he remembers. I can reconnect with that feeling now. It was all laid bare. When Scott joined Harry and Joplin for some of the reporting for this week's story, he tried to place himself, deciphering where he walked 15 years earlier, and how that connected to where he was today. The built landscape, of course, had totally changed. He finally oriented himself by the cross of a church at the top of a hill, a cross that was still standing after the tornado. What hadn't changed, Scott and Harry found, were the hearts of the people in Joplin. Their first stop was the office of the newspaper with which Scott had volunteered, and where the editor was now eager to help Scott and Harry with their work. "Nearly everyone in Joplin agrees," Harry writes in his story. "The tornado left a legacy of commitment to one another." And here follows Harry Ruinus's story from Joplin, Missouri, entitled, "In Joplin, our tornado took things you remember, but the city's civic bonds endure." The first time Joplin called out to Charles Timothy Pay, it called from the ruins. He, like so many Americans, saw the reports of the mile-wide tornado that tore through his southwest Missouri city on Sunday, May 22, 2011. It was one of the most devastating tornadoes in American history, killing 161 people and leaving a scar of splintered neighborhoods, wrecked schools, a hospital jolted off its foundation. He was stunned. Mr. P.A., people call him Tim, is a veteran of Operation Desert Storm, a soldier who came home from war carrying memories that made civilian life difficult. Yet he's drawn to service. "I grew up a preacher's kid," he says. "You get more out of helping people than you do standing by looking." So he saw the television images and answered Joplin's call, driving down from St. Louis to put his hands on the wreckage. He was one of more than 100,000 volunteers who would come to Joplin and join people already looking to mend their own wounded city, together creating a legacy of community building that reverberates 15 years later. Some of them stayed for years. Some came for a week, a day, an afternoon. Mr. Pay came for as long as he could. So much of the city seemed to him erased. People were moving debris and still trying to find survivors. He remembers hearing animals that were trapped or injured somewhere in the wreckage. The scene was like the urban battlefields he knew too well, perhaps worse. "Other than going to war, I hadn't seen that kind of devastation on a city," he says. He had to leave earlier than planned, after just 2 days. The second time Joplin called out to Mr. P.A., it was through his own need to be restored. In the Marine Corps, he was an anti-tank assaultman, a tank killer, he says. He served in the heart of frontline combat. After the war, he could not quite get himself together. He could not go places. He could not talk to people. It was hard to hold down jobs. "I got off into alcohol and drug use," he says. "I kept spiraling after his experience in Joplin. That kept me out for a while." By 2013, 2 years after the tornado, he was trying to find a way back into his life. He got help in St. Louis. An organization directed him to Joplin, this time for sober living at the HOUSE, Inc., and HVAC training at Franklin Technology Center. The arrangement, as he remembers it, was simple. He could live there for a modest rent, go to school, and refrain from drinking and taking drugs. "I said, well, I can do that," he says. He didn't choose to come to the city where he had volunteered, and it felt a bit confining, but he stayed sober, and he graduated a few months later. Then he quickly left, and he was glad to. "Joplin looked so good in my rearview mirror when I was leaving after HVAC school," he says. "But the place still carried bad memories. Get away," he thought as he drove off. The third time Joplin called out to Mr. P.A., it was through a newborn child. After his recovery, he lived and worked in the Chicago area for a while. After a relationship there did not work out, he went back to St. Louis by way of Springfield, Missouri, where he spent some time with a friend. There, he met the woman who would later become his wife. By 2018, he had a son, a little Tim. "Well, I guess he's not that little," he says of his 8-year-old, holding up a palm to show his height. "I have to call him medium Tim now." Back then, he was thinking about the best place to start a new life with a family, about schools for medium Tim. He considered the Chicago area. He considered St. Louis. Then it struck him, moved to Joplin, the city that had first looked to him like war and then given him a place to recover from his own. Joplin was quieter. It felt safer. The schools and ball fields were new. Everything's state of the art there, he says, of the rebuilt city. And it sits right in the middle of 4 states, close enough to Kansas, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and the rest of Missouri. A person could be somewhere else quickly. So I said, okay, well, I'll just plant it here, he said. Still, he struggled at first. When I first got here, I couldn't go to Walmart. I couldn't be around a lot of people, he says. But the first time I talked myself into going, I had a big basket of groceries and somebody tapped me on the shoulder. You a veteran? I had my veteran hat on. She said, let me get in front of you. And she paid for my groceries. It happened maybe 4 times since. He went to work for the HOUSE Inc., serving as a substance abuse counselor for the organization that helped him restore his life. In a different way, it was happening again. It's worked out really well for me, just being able to help and give back, especially to those who went through the same thing I did, he says. He was encouraged to apply for a house through Habitat for Humanity. He was skeptical, but his family was approved to purchase a new home, one that was being made with specially designed concrete forms on a lot that had been in the tornado's path. During construction, neighbors came around to watch. The concrete walls were something of an experiment, part of a grant partnership with the National Ready Mixed Concrete Association and Habitat for Humanity to build structurally resilient housing. Today, Mr. P.A. surrounds his home with patriotic flags, the stars and stripes in the Marine Corps scarlet and gold, a perimeter of red, white, and blue around a house he says he's so proud to own. It's the 250th birthday of the U.S. of A., and we can thank veterans for that, he says, standing in his front lawn, an outspoken patriot in his neighborhood. A few years ago, there was another tornado scare. A woman came first, walking towards his door with a baby in her arms. She said, did you say this was a concrete house? Mr. P.A. recalls. I said, yes, it's okay. Then 5 more neighbors came over. The man who had once found it so difficult to be around people opened his door so that his home, sitting on Joplin's erstwhile scar, became a safe house on the block. Mr. P.A.'s house is one answer to what Joplin became after the tornado, a city where recovery was measured not only in what rose again, but in who found shelter there. The shelter did not appear to by accident. It came from volunteers, churches, private donors, and federal aid. Local institutions, too, were suddenly tasked to do more than they had ever done. Leaders who had to look at the ruins and imagine the machinery of repair. On May 23, 2011, the day after the tornado destroyed a third of the city, Scott Clayton was one of those leaders, standing on a hill on 22nd Street, disoriented and beset with self-doubt. He had been born and raised just outside Joplin in a small town called Oronogo, and for the first year and a half, he had been the director of the local Habitat for Humanity affiliate. The office he took over had built 1, maybe 2 houses a year since its founding in 1989, for a total of 29 in 22 years. He was at a friend's house, or what was left of it, on high ground that should have been hemmed in by roof lines, oak canopy, and the ordinary scenes of a city he had long lived and worked within. Instead, it lay open to the horizon, and the one tree still standing beside him In it hung a Habitat for Humanity trailer, carried whole into the branches. It wasn't just one simple thing, Mr. Clayton says, describing the questions swirling in his mind, the loss of life, the people he knew, and mostly what he and Habitat for Humanity as a housing nonprofit needed to be doing right now. I think the main thing I thought personally at the beginning was, am I the right person for this, he says. For several months, he felt overwhelmed, as many did. The need was too large to fit the old Habitat rhythms. The tornado damaged nearly 7,500 residences and 530 business structures. More than 3,000 residences were heavily damaged or completely destroyed. As Mr. Clayton surveyed his city, it was a place where thousands of families had lost not only roofs and walls, but their familiar landmarks by which they had known where they were. But he went to work and took it one day at a time. Most of the initial work was simply slow and steady cleanup. Mr. Clayton was scheduled for meetings he did not feel up to, but he went anyway. He worked 60 and 70-hour weeks, took calls on Sundays, and tried to turn grief into structure, creating schedules for volunteers, lists of donated funds, and plans to build new houses. The hours took their toll until his oldest son, then a child, told him plainly that he needed to be home more. As he struggled to find balance, however, what came next still astonishes him. His Habitat affiliate became something of a clearinghouse for the kindness of the whole country. Joplin was beginning to rebuild in many ways, both hundreds of millions of dollars in federal aid arriving through multiple streams, but for private donors, corporate partners, and thousands of volunteers eager to contribute too, Habitat for Humanity and Mr. Clayton became a focus of their efforts to help the city rebuild the housing that was lost. I was Scott, the Habitat tornado guy, he says. His job really became being a professional volunteer workday coordinator. For the next 3 years, he worked with local churches, which turned themselves into supply depots and volunteer centers. Habitat's affiliates in Tulsa, Oklahoma, came to town and made news with a plan to raise 10 houses for 10 families in 10 days, which ended up being 16 days. Then the rest of the country arrived with its sleeves rolled up. State Farm, Home Depot, and the Salvation Army helped fund or build homes. Baseball players from Kansas City Royals and St. Louis Cardinals framed houses alongside retirees. A work crew arrived from the United Arab Emirates. Mr. Clayton and his staff were running crews of 100 across 5 build sites at once. Mr. Clayton's small affiliate built 36 houses in 2012, 32 the year after. By October 2015, it had built 100 after the storm. Reporters came too. They wanted to talk about devastation. Mr. Clayton understood why, but he wanted them to see the story from the other side of the storm. To us, it wasn't the devastation that was important, he says. It wasn't the story of everything's gone. It's everything we're doing to rebuild. It's everything we do that's positive. It wasn't about May 22nd, he adds. It was about May 23rd and everything that followed. But rebuilding Joplin was not the same as restoring it. The tornado did not merely knock down houses. It changed the city's housing math. Official recovery documents counted 3,422 units completely damaged or destroyed. The Department of Housing and Urban Development later estimated that the storm destroyed about 1,800 rental units and damaged another 1,500, leaving Joplin's rental vacancy rate below 1%. Many of those homes were not grand. Some were old, imperfect, and easy to overlook, but they were also part of the city's lower-cost housing stock. Mr. Clayton saw that from the builder's side, before the tornado, pretty much half the town was in a rental situation, he says. So you have a lot of aging housing stock that maybe had cost-effective rental that was taken away. In the years since, costs have only climbed. When he first started at Habitat, a housing lot might have cost them $4,000. Later, $10,000 began to feel like the edge of the budget. Now, he says, lots can run $20,000 or more. A recent Habitat home cost $165,000 to build and appraised for $250,000. The work is still necessary, but it's no longer the same work. We're trying to do affordable housing in an increasingly unaffordable world, he says, which is why, 15 years after the tornado, Mr. Clayton is asking what kind of shelter people actually need. At a new Habitat project in town, he walks past the frame of a 10-unit rental complex for veterans, 6 one-bedroom apartments, 4 two-bedrooms, all low-cost rents. Habitat has built houses for veterans, including Mr. P.A.'s concrete home, on a lot once crossed by the tornado. But home ownership is not always what veterans ask for. They listened, Mr. Clayton says, and what they heard was specific. Veterans wanted smaller units, rent instead of a mortgage, a place in town. The new project is meant to give veterans not only lower rents, but a little of the camaraderie that can be hard to carry from military life into civilian life. Mr. Pierre's concrete house was one answer to what shelter could mean in the Joplin that came after the storm. The veterans' complex is another. At first, Joplin had to build quickly. Over time, it had to learn to build more carefully, around the lives people were trying to rebuild, inside the walls. 20 years ago, just as Joplin had once called to Mr. P.A. and Mr. Clayton, it had beckoned Nicole Brown, too. She and her husband were riding the professional rodeo circuit then, a part-time passion as both pursued careers in education. Joplin made practical sense for the couple. It was close enough to Oklahoma, Kansas, Arkansas, and Texas to follow the rodeo circuit, while still offering a lovely place to build a life. It's kind of the same reason, like, why you have trucking and things here, she says. You can be anywhere relatively quickly. That has always been part of the Joplin's claim on the American map. Before it was Route 66 town, it was a mining boom town in the traditions of American capitalism after the Civil War, drawing thousands to mine the massive lead and zinc fields of the tri-state district. Later, the old road made it a working crossroads, a place to stop, repair, refuel, and regroup. Ms. Brown, who has a Ph.D. in higher education administration, began working for a local university, building a career helping students find their next step. Joplin fit a habit of mind she already had. On May 22, 2011, Ms. Brown and her husband were in the basement of their century-old house in Denwig. The tornado was flattening Joplin and heading their way. Acquaintances from her husband's workplace were returning from the Joplin High School graduation when raining debris sent them to the Browns' house. You've just never heard a house groan like that in your life, she says. The entire house is over 100 years old, and it was very well built. You could hear the pressure coming in on the house. Her house survived with minor damage. That left her, like many, in a strange emotional category. There was a lot of trauma in our community, she says. People fell in one or two groups. You either were directly impacted and you were working your way through that, or you had a survivor's guilt because you weren't. But nearly everyone in Joplin agrees the tornado left a legacy of commitment to one another, a profound experience of organizing volunteers and coordinating civic services. One Joplin, the organization Ms. Brown now leads, emerged from that legacy and now preserves the collaboration the disaster had forced into being. It does not run a shelter or build houses. It connects people who do. The magic of One Joplin a lot of times happens in the hallway conversations, she said. A career change as she begins to raise 2 young children. It gets people out of their offices, gets them in together, and it builds trust across those organizations. That may be less visible story of Joplin's recovery. The city did not merely replace buildings. It learned under pressure how to connect churches, nonprofits, businesses, and civic leaders around shared needs. But Ms. Brown is careful with the language of recovery. Some losses, she says, were hidden inside what outsiders might have called improvement. It can be easy from a distance to say the tornado cleared away old houses and that newer, better homes rose in their place, but she asks, who lived in those houses? For families with insurance or savings, recovering could mean rebuilding. For those who lost a cheap rental and perhaps the job that paid for it, recovery could mean displacement. The tornado created a dividing line of what their reality was for recovery for many families, she said. A city can come back, but it can't return unchanged. It can build stronger walls and still lose affordable rooms to rent. It can remember the volunteers, the houses, the days after, and yet still carry voids where the private histories used to stand. Along Route 66, America has long told stories about motion, leaving, arriving, and starting over somewhere down the road. Joplin's tornado story asks a slower question. What makes people stay? What calls them back? And when they return, what kind of shelter is waiting? For Mr. Pierre, it was a concrete house in the tornado's old path, a door he could open when neighbors came. For Mr. Clayton, it became a lifetime of building homes around new needs. For Ms. Brown, it's the patient work of keeping people in the same room long enough to hear what the city needs next. 15 years after the storm, they and others still hear the call that came first from the ruins. They can't solve all challenges at once, nor for everyone equally, but door by door, meeting by meeting, wall by wall, they're still asking and answering how to make a place strong enough for those looking for a way back. And that's all the time we have for today's reading. I'm Joanne Lowney, your volunteer broadcaster on Sun Sounds of Arizona. Stay tuned for more interesting programs on Sun Sounds.